testimony on Senate Bill 472, and the chair apologizes that the committees are not full of members. The Republican caucus went way overboard.
I think he's got people ready to testify in bulk.
All right. Now, Senator Corcoran, do you want to come up and testify on one or two bills? Or 472 and 473?
She doesn't need to talk to you. It's actually, she needs to talk to you. She said, no, no, no.
Well,
yes, yes. You want to talk to her about it? You didn't tell me that. You asked me to ask her if she needed to talk to you.
Senator?
Thank you, Chairman Ennis, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. Thank you, especially Senator Menace and Senator Courtney, for sponsoring Senate Bills 472 and 473. I just want to relay a little bit of information about the occurrence that brings us to these bills today. And then I'm going to have Kelly and Janet Lovelace, the parents of Katie Lovelace, talk to you a bit. We also have District Attorney Harkleroad, Assistant District Attorney Eric Hasselman, former Representative Floyd Brzezanski, who was instrumental in helping put this language together. And we also have two members of the Lane County Sheriff's Office that were involved in the investigation. So with that, basically, on the evening of June 9, 2000, Lee Russell Stubbs was driving a van and, according to investigators, may have been distracted and misjudged the distance between his van and three children walking on the roadside. He hit and killed his neighbor, Katie Lovelace, a 12-year-old girl. It's what he did next and the punishment he received subsequently that created these two bills. In essence, it was a hit-and-run scene, and then Stubbs returned to the scene minutes later and then drove away a second time. He then parked his van, and then the next 4 days, he bought deer fur at a fly fishing store to put on the van to support his lie about hitting a deer. An auto body repairman who ironically had lost a child to a hit-and-run driver became suspicious and notified the Lane County Sheriff's Office. When confronted by the investigator, Stubbs acknowledged his guilt. On August 2, 2000, Lee Stubbs was sentenced to approximately 40 months in prison for killing this young girl. There was quite a controversy in the Eugene community regarding this, a lot of letters to the editor, a lot of phone calls to local law enforcement and local media about the issue being basically how can an accused hit-and-run driver who's desperately trying to hide his crime get only 40 months in prison? And basically it has to do with the, in many respects, with the laws that currently exist. Even though Stubbs admitted he had been drinking before the accident, he wasn't arrested until 5 days later, so there wasn't any physical evidence. Had he been drunk, the crime would have been manslaughter because he would have met the criteria of recklessly disregarding the risk that someone might be killed if he drove while drinking. And then accident experts calculated that his speed was at about 57 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone, again, not high enough to prove the recklessness necessary for a conviction, for a higher conviction. So in essence, Mr. Stubbs pled guilty to the harshest crimes that Assistant DA Eric Hasselman believed that the prosecutors could prove. He was quoted in the paper at the time saying, I can't give him any more prison time than he's going to get. So basically, Stubbs got 20 months for criminally negligent homicide, 18 months for hit-and-run driving, and 1 year for tampering with evidence. And that 1 year was reduced to 2 months because of jail overcrowding. Senate Bill 472 would increase the penalty for failure to perform the duties of a driver if the accident results in a fatality from a crime category of 6 to a crime category of 8. And the companion bill, Senate Bill 473, would move criminally negligent homicide to the same level as manslaughter in the second degree, which is crime category 9. Now you're going to hear testimony from Katie's parents, Kelly and Janet. And I just want to say that since the day I received a call from Kathy Gerritsen, my constituent and Katie's aunt, I've been very impressed with this family's single-minded focus on bringing some positive closure to this tragedy. The thing that I really admire about the Lovelaces is that they've been clear from the outset that they wanted to prevent any future occurrence of this type by closing a loophole in our sentencing guidelines. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to the Lovelaces.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. I am Janet Lovelace. Katie was my daughter. It's been, if there was any way possible for me to have each one of you here in this room feel what it's like to lose a child, I would do that just for one moment. I never knew such pain existed. I have apologized to many people since we've lost Katie for being reading in the paper and thinking, my gosh, how sad for that family, without ever knowing the real pain. At the sentencing of Lee Stubbs, I spoke for 37 minutes. I will not do that. I talked about my daughter. She was my very good friend. She was a bright, beautiful girl, just like I'm sure maybe all of you have girls, boys. They're all so important to us. And until something like this happens, which you never think will happen to you, I felt like I need to apologize to those people that had lost children before me. The night of June 9th, 2000, has thrown my family, myself, my husband, into the depths of pain that I never knew existed. But the reason I'm here is because I want to be able to say that I can say right now, Katie's life made a difference. She had over 1,000 people at a memorial service at the school. People to this day tell me Katie was a special child. I want to make sure that her death also makes a difference. The sentencing that Lee Stubbs received was inadequate. That's not just my opinion. That is opinion of many, many people. It's hard sometimes for me to even imagine that this man is a member of the human race. None of us would ever think to do something as he did after the fact. Again, my main reason for being here is to ask for your assistance, your help. You have the power to make the change that needs to be done here. So I ask that you push forward Bill 472 and 473 so that the next family that is in our situation, and it could be you and your family, that there would be a more fair sentencing. I believe that the DA, the judges, their hands are all tied, and I know from the beginning I was told that it was the power of Salem to do this. So I do hope that you can understand a little bit of this truly in your heart, and let's help the next family. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Lovelace.
I'm Kelly Lovelace. Katie was my daughter. What really bothers you as a parent and a member of society, I hope, is that this Lee Stubbs, by running once he committed this, actually, we feel if he got caught, he did better than if he had stayed, because he'd been drinking, and probably, even though we can't prove it, we're sure as neighbors and as law officers I've visited with, nobody can prove it because of the time frame that he had been drinking too much, but more than likely he was. And simply by running and then getting caught later, he reduced any sentence he would get. And so you've rewarded him at that. And if we're going to look at rewarding somebody for running, then we're in trouble. We need people to be willing to take responsibility for their actions at whatever level. And if they are willing to shirk them to gain, then we need to make sure that they can't gain. And in fact, the punishment is more than if they'd stopped. So if he'd stopped and been drinking been over the legal limit, then that would be one thing, and he'd had to pay that price. But if he ran, and we couldn't prove that he'd been drinking, then that price should still be greater. That is a justice system that is delivering what we expect from people. That's what I hope these two bills will accomplish. I would like to say that all the officers and the district attorney and everybody that's been involved in this so far to date with me has been very professional, has done everything in their power to make things work right and to the best of their ability. And as a family, we've certainly appreciated that. I think these two bills are going to help our justice system in this state and are something that all of us can appreciate. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Lovis. Thank you, Senator. Mrs. Lovis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have now the Pat O'Neill and Kevin Woodworth from Lane County Sheriff's Office. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chairman and committee members, it's a privilege to be here before you today to speak briefly on this topic. My name is Kevin Woodworth. I'm a sergeant at the Lane County Sheriff's Office. I supervise our traffic safety team for Lane County as well as our major crash team. And on my right is Pat O'Neill, a deputy with the Sheriff's Office, and he was one of the lead investigators for my team on the Lovelace case. Briefly, today we wanted to come and support both of the Senate bills that are before you. In the Lovelace case, it was clear to us, as a number of other high-profile cases that we've had in the Lane County area involving fatalities, the lack of punishment that's out there, our hope is that this is the right direction to take to try to send the message to the public out there that if you choose to do this type of crime, that there is a level of punishment. To think that somebody goes out and kills a person using a vehicle and they've made a conscious choice to get behind the wheel after they've been drinking, there needs to be an appropriate level of punishment for those people. And so I don't think I need to go into the facts of the case. I just wanted to be here and show that the law enforcement community is in support of both these bills. Pat O'Neill, I'll give an opportunity to speak if he needs to say anything.
Thank you, Chairman Minnis and committee. As law enforcement, it's very frustrating knowing that we go to these accidents and we do these, quite frankly, we've had 5 deaths in the last 3 or 4 weeks. And the frustrating part on the hit and run part is you go there and the person's ran, and a lot of times you assume they've been intoxicated, and you know that because they decided to run, that they're going to lower their sentence if they get caught. So they're rolling the dice, and we're actually rewarding them for running because we lose that evidence of them being intoxicated, and because the hit and run is a lesser punishment than, say, manslaughter, it's certainly a benefit for them to run, and that's a frustration for us. Thank you. That's all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the deputy sheriff, please. Thank you very much for coming up from Eugene today to testify. I'd like to ask the district attorney, Mr. Harkelrode, and the assistant district attorney, Mr. Hasselman, now we are also joined by Representative Brzezinski, who's also moving in our direction here. I didn't ask him, but you can see this. Thank you. Yes, Floyd.
He's just barging in, is he, Mr. Chair?
No, he's doing it fine. Floyd was a deputy DA, too, I believe.
I don't know how you want to go, gentlemen. Which one was, I guess, how?
Mr. Hasselman first.
Mr. Hasselman, Mr. DA. All right, Mr. Hasselman, would you speak first, please? The chair had to go to a subcommittee meeting. He'll be back in case you want to know what happened to him. So that's where John is. Thank you.
Well, I thank the vice chair, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. My name is Eric Hasselman. I'm an assistant district attorney with Lane County. I work for the district attorney, Doug Harkelrode. I appreciate the opportunity to address the members of the committee on these two Senate bills, Senate bills 472 and 473 today. You've heard, obviously, from the testimony from the people that it's impacted the most, the Lovelaces, at least in the last year. Both of these bills, I think, are long overdue. I'm a member of our vehicular homicide team, and as both Deputy O'Neill and Sergeant Woodworth indicated, traffic deaths in our county with potential criminal culpability are not rare, unfortunately. We have probably over a dozen people a year who are killed in traffic collisions, which are the result of criminal behavior on the part of a driver. There's probably more than that, but there's probably at least an equal number that of at-fault drivers who are killed during those collisions as well that we do not prosecute. Senate Bill 472 would increase the level on the felony sentencing guidelines of a hit-and-run where the perpetrator, the actions of the perpetrator or the result of the collision is a fatality. Right now we treat fatal hit-and-runs the same as we do whiplash-type injuries. They're all as a level 6 on our felony sentencing guidelines. I think the law needs to recognize that traffic collisions that result in a death are more serious in the eyes of the public. I can tell the committee that I responded within an hour to the scene of the Loveless accident, as the members of our vehicular homicide team do. I unfortunately got to see the aftermath of Mr. Stubbs' actions and see Katie Loveless's body still in the ditch where Mr. Stubbs had left it after this tragic collision. I can tell you that as a member of society, not just a deputy district attorney, that I wanted to get this guy that had done this and run off. But we had to wait 5 days for that because this individual did not come forward. This individual did not have the courage to take responsibility for his actions. He attempted to hide his conduct even further, and it left this family for 5 days not knowing if there was somebody trying to kill members of their family or what. They had no answer to the questions that were in their mind, which just compounded the misery of the loss that they'd suffered. As I've indicated, I'm fully in support as a practicing member of the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of this particular bill. Senate Bill 473 also recognizes that there's a disparity currently between negligent homicide and manslaughter in the second degree. Manslaughter in the second degree by this legislature has been classified as one of the so-called Measure 11 sentences, sentences that are subject to ORS 137.700. If we're able to establish that driving fatality was the result of a reckless action, the person is subject to a mandatory minimum of 75 months. However, if we can only establish that they're criminally negligent, a person such as Mr. Stubbs, who had a conviction for reckless driving, or a person even with two DUIIs to their credit in the past, could again drive under the influence, result in a fatality, and over the state's objection, a sentencing court could impose an optional probation sentence with no mandatory time in incarceration. I recognize that a lot of the types of cases that we have involving criminally negligent homicides involve young people that perhaps are too young to be responsibly drinking, or legally drinking for that matter, and who unfortunately through their reckless conduct result in the death of a passenger or another member. This would still give us the authority and the sentencing court the authority under the guidelines to impose a downward departure sentence to a period of probation if that was appropriate under the circumstances. But what this also does is gives us the latitude to impose up to the maximum statutory sentence, which on a Class C felony is 5 years in prison. Currently, criminally negligent homicide is a level 8 offense, and the maximum sentence that can be imposed, even if a person has three or more violent person felonies to their criminal history, is 45 months. It's not even the maximum statutory sentence that a person could receive, and that's just not right. We think this both of these bills will fix that problem and will allow us to impose sentences that are more commensurate with the actual harm caused. I'll tell the committee that I received more phone calls in support of raising the potential sentence on these two types of crimes than I have in any other single case that I've handled in the last 6 years as a prosecutor. The community in Lane County was definitely in support of this type of increase in the potential criminal liability that a person would suffer after participating in these kind of actions. I would tell the committee that as it stood on the hit-and-run charge where this man had left the scene, not knowing whether he'd killed this young girl or not, he left the scene, didn't even bother to stop and find out if he could help, he was subject to a presumptive term of 3 years of probation with 30 days in the Lane County Jail had he been apprehended and had he not had a sentencing judge impose an upward departure to 18 months in the Department of Corrections. And as the Loveless family expressed so eloquently earlier, that's just not right under these circumstances. I thank the committee.
Thank you. Who wishes to speak now, Representative?
Okay. Doug Harkleroad, Vice Chair Courtney. My name is Doug Harkleroad. I'm the district attorney in Lane County. I've been district attorney since 1985, and I was in the office for 11 years before that. I tell you that because I have seen these cases come and go for a long period of time. And what I think these two Senate bills do is to close a relatively small but significant loophole in the sentencing guidelines that we have and have had since November of 1989. Mr. Hassman has adequately described for you just exactly, I think, what these bills will do. And in essence, what they do is they raise the bar for negligent homicide, and they raise the bar for failure to perform the duties of a driver involved in an accident, i.e. hit and run. But they do not raise it so high that there is no judicial discretion. They do not put either one of these into the so-called ballot measure 11. They just make it more serious under the sentencing guidelines grid, and I believe that's appropriate, not just because of the Loveless case, although that's the spark that gets us here, but because of other cases where the surviving victims have not been so articulate and so forward-looking as Mr. and Mrs. Loveless have. The last thing I would tell you is that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports the passage of both of these bills.
Thank you, Representative Brzezinski. I might add before we begin, in his written testimony that he has given us, on the back of it, he has the actual grid of sentencing guidelines color-coded, so I want to point that out too. Representative Brzezinski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and Senators. As Senator Courtney has said, there is a grid chart on the back, and I have color-coded it so you can see what the changes would be and how the guidelines would be impacted. I want to first tell you that the Lovelaces were constituents of mine when this tragedy occurred. It's true that Senator Corcoran was contacted by an aunt of the Lovelaces, and at that point, we decided that we needed to figure out what we could do to make this right in the future. We understand that at this point, Katie is not going to be brought back by any type of legislation, and that's not the goal of this. And dealing with the Lovelaces on this matter, they have been very forthright that they want to make certain that there is justice, but at the same time, they want to make certain that there is balance within the system. What we have attempted to do is do just that by taking the sentencing guidelines and modifying them to take in consideration the concerns that have been raised by the different panels that you've heard today. Currently, under the Oregon law, when you have an individual who commits the crime of failure to perform the duties of a driver, it depends on what type of damage or injuries occur as to how they're classified. If it's just damage only, it's not a felony, it's a misdemeanor. Currently, under our law, under 811.705, if it is injury or death, they are treated the same. And we believe that it is necessary to make another distinction and make this more or less, let's say, a third level. So where you individually have an individual who has committed the crime of hit and run, and there is a fatality that results, there should be a more severe penalty than if it was just an injury. This is what we're accomplishing through Senate Bill 472. It will, in fact, raise the level from a level 6, which is under the line, as it's called, within the prosecution office, where the person would be presumed to be getting a probation sentence, and it's going to put it above the line where we assure that they will be facing prison time unless there is a downward departure. This is important from our perspective because it will, in fact, make certain that these individuals are going to be held accountable for their conduct. Now, under the level eight, there is the potential that they could receive optional probation. We believe that that was part of the original sentencing guidelines to give courts where you have individuals with little to no criminal past history to be able to demonstrate to the court that they would be appropriate for that type of treatment. If they are not able to do so, they will in fact serve prison time. Also, it's worth noting that when you have an individual who commits the crime of hit and run where there is a death, we believe that it will be essential that we clarify the distinction of the duty. Now, the duty is not necessarily to the victim, even though we would think that there is a duty to the victim. It is to the state because they failed to report the crime. But where this legislature has previously stated and has demonstrated that it will, in fact, change the level of penalty that someone will face based on the type of accident they're involved in, we think this would be appropriate and will be succinct with the originators of the sentencing guideline grid. The last bill of 473 will deal with what is, as Eric Kossman has said, it will be a discrepancy that we currently have with criminal negligent homicide as well as manslaughter in the second degree. Both of those are currently level eights. It is appropriate, we believe, that they should be moved up to a level nine. That will take them out of the optional probation period or sectors for the the three lower levels of crime or individuals with criminal histories. But it will not keep the court from doing a downward departure. They feel it's appropriate. Again, this is a necessary change, and I want to make certain, and I want to put it on the record, that this change in moving manslaughter in the second degree to a crime seriousness of a 9 will not have any impact on its current sentencing structure under Measure 11. It will still retain the 75 months. The reason that we need to move it up is because once we move the criminal negligent homicide up for proportionality to make certain that we would meet any type of court challenge, they need to be equal. If not, manslaughter 2 would have to be greater. So what we're basically doing is moving both of those from a level 8 to a level 9. They will stay proportionate in that sense, and we'll also make certain that an individual such as Mr. Stubbs can be held accountable for the conduct that he was involved in, even though he did make flight for good reason, and that reason is because he knew that he would have been faced with a manslaughter in the second degree charge. It is the opinion of most individuals that have seen this case that he was, in fact, under the influence of intoxicants at the time that he committed the crime that that resulted in the death of Katie Lovelace. So what I want to show to you is if you look at his criminal history, it was an H. He would be under these two bills if they were in law at the time of this incident. He would be looking at a level 9 H as well as a level 8. The level 9 would go for the criminal negligent homicide. That would mean that he would have a prison term presumed of 37 to 38 months. And on the hit and run where there's a fatality, there would be a presumption of a prison term of 19 to 20 months unless the court agreed that he should receive optional probation. If there's questions that you have regarding the sentencing guidelines or the approach that we took and why we brought these bills forward under this set, please ask us.
Questions? Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back, Floyd. Quite boring without you.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Existing statute lumps injury and death together. That, to me, seems weird. Do you have any feel for the background of why we did that to start with? Not that it matters a lot.
Not being here myself, maybe Vice Chair Senator Courtney may be able to give a little more explanation as to how that was divided up as to why it occurred. I would assume, and maybe Doug may also have some input for this as well, is that they were looking at the type of crime in the sense that failure to perform the duties of a driver or what we refer to as hit and run does not really have a victim per se. The state is the victim. It is because of the duty failure to give the insurance information, your driver's license information, as at the scene of the crime or the scene of the accident, is what they were attempting to punish. But we agree with you, Senator Harper, that that is not an appropriate level of punishment when you look at the severity of the situation.
Yeah. Okay.
I think, Mr. Chair, if I might, Mr. Vice Chair, if I might, I believe I know the answer. Sentencing guidelines came into effect in 1989, and prior to that, there was a commission that built the guidelines and built the grid, and the legislature did not individually consider each of the various categories and where they should fall. And so what happened was failure to perform the duties of a driver involved in an accident was a Class C felony if it was a injury or death, a 5-year sentence potentially, or it was a misdemeanor. And then when we did the guidelines grids, or when the commission did it, they didn't divide it up into 3 sets. There was just 2 sets, and so they gave it a category, and that was it.
The statute itself has always, at least from my review of it, has maintained the injury and the fatality in one. And so that's how they got looped or grouped into the grid blocks as they did. What we're basically going to do and how this legislation would read, it will still be in the same statute, but if the result is fatality versus injury, then they will be looking at the enhanced penalty.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
One idea that Council and I were floating here in this situation with Ms. Loveless, the defendant in that case did some extraordinary things to try to conceal his involvement. But this doesn't address that concealing or those other extraordinary actions, tampering with evidence, this kind of thing. So the bill as written would escalate it if the incident involved the death of an individual. But what about the tampering with the evidence, the concealing of evidence, this kind of thing?
I'm going to ask Mr. Hasselman, Mr. Chair, to answer that question.
Thank you, Chairman. What I'd say to that point is that that's tampering with evidence. Trying to modify evidence to conceal a crime is a Class A misdemeanor under statute, punishable by up to a year in jail. But as far as the gravamen of the offense was going, that was just a continuing action to what we felt was the more severe crime in this, and that was leaving the scene and not even allowing this family to find out who it was that was responsible for her daughter's death or the circumstances regarding it. The sheriff was working to build up a physical reconstruction of the accident because we didn't have the information given to us by the driver of the person who'd caused it. And so, again, the main gravamen of this offense, where we think the majority of the moral depravity lie, was in the running from the scene when you'd caused an accident that resulted in the death of a person. Just tampering with evidence, we have a lot of school kids who are always trying to hide things from their parents, doctoring things up. You throw put a golf ball down and inside the window you broke just to show mom, hey, it was an errant golf ball from somebody. That was not as important to us as the fact that at the time we weren't able to investigate the circumstances of the criminal action of the driving and the collision that took Katie's life. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but the penalty for the tampering in the people that I've discussed with, obviously that was a major concern that this man had gone out and bought deer hair to try to corroborate his story that he'd struck a deer instead of a person. But if he'd actually stopped at the scene, there wouldn't even be that question as to what he'd hit.
Right, but if the bill as it's constructed, you're a prosecutor, you would have to prove that this individual, I assume, was driving the car, was involved in the accident, and fled without complying with the responsibilities of a driver, and that someone died as a result of that. End of story. So that would take into account someone who perhaps didn't know that someone had died, In fact, they could have been injured and been in the hospital for a week and a half or so, and then died. Then it's still a B felony. But I think that in the Loveless case, you have someone who's done something extraordinary, which tells me that person knew that they had more likely than not killed someone. It's, of course, their action. So it seems to me that that's kind of an important element in this.
Mr. Harcourt and I spoke about this, and we addressing the concerns that were here before you, we thought that this was the first step. If the chair is looking at potentially having an enhanced penalty where someone has tampered with evidence of a crime that results in the death of an individual, there would be no objection from any of us as to having that enhancement. I agree with the chair that when you have somebody that, in this particular case, this individual did come back to the scene and is in all likelihood knew what he had done, and then he took the extraordinary steps to try to cover it up. And clearly, I think in my time here in the legislature, and both of you gentlemen have been here longer than all of us have seen, they're looking at trying to take care of these in-betweens. And this is one of those ones that I would agree with the chair, that if the chair would want to somehow include a stiffer penalty based on the attempt to cover or tamper with evidence to cover up their wrongdoing where it resulted in a more serious injury or death, that'd be something that would be supported by the panel that's before you.
I mean, I'm thinking this is the minimum threshold. You have evidence where somebody's tampering with evidence, which would tend to indicate that they know full well that they killed someone, or more likely than not did, and perhaps an A felony would be appropriate.
If it pleases the chair, one way the legislature could address that is through a modification or an addition of an aggravating factor, which would justify an upward departure sentence from, as you say, the minimum. This is a minimum starting point. That would allow the court to take the presumptive sentence that they're entitled to and as much as double it due to perhaps circumstances under which somebody is trying to tamper with evidence to conceal the commission of their crime.
Okay. That seems to make some sense to me. Any other questions, Senator Metzger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And somewhat on the same line as of the chair, I was wondering, we have this example, this horrific example of young Katie, and we deal, in this case, with her death and enhancing that penalty. Just trying to think back, if we had this bill enacted and into law, and the same exact same circumstances had occurred, when she would have been hit, someone tried to hide it with the deer hair, but she did not die and was, say, permanently paralyzed for the rest of her life, extremely injured. Whether the outcry of the community would have been any less, and I'm saying no, they would still be upset over that sentence for what this young girl would have to go through the rest of her life. And maybe just thinking out loud, Mr. Chair, but along the same lines, if there's any way, or what your consideration may have given just in addition not only to death, but any type of serious injury like that where someone would leave that scene and, as the chair said, knowingly, try to do something about that. I don't know how you differentiate different injuries, but I could certainly foresee that same situation being just as egregious to the society and yet be back in that same original penalty phase.
Doug Harcourt, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My thought is if you wanted to have four categories rather than three, the three being property, injury, and death, and move that to property, physical injury, already defined in the statute, serious physical injury, already defined in the statute with the body of case law, and death, you could build a gradation there, which I think is what you're trying to do, to get a more serious penalty, depending on the seriousness of the injury. That could be done fairly simply.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tend to like that approach. All right. Any other comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ann and Bruce Pratt.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt, and I'm from Lane County. I'm here to, I am a member of Crime Victims United and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, but I'm here today speaking in my own behalf. I'm here to ask you to pass Bill, Senate Bill 473, and also support the Lovelace family on Bill 472. I have written testimony, so I'd like to say a few words. When a hit-and-run driver killed Kitty Lovelace in June of last year, I took it very personally. I was outraged when I learned that Russell Lee Stubbs faced a total of only 40 months, and I wondered where Katie's family would find justice. I knew it wouldn't be in the 40-month combined sentence of criminally negligent homicide, hit-and-run, and evidence tampering. Just 21 months prior to Katie's death, we lost our 20-year-old son, excuse me, to a drunk driver. The circumstances were different, but the drunk driver, Kyle William Wilson, had a similar driving record, which included 8 driving suspensions and a not-my-fault attitude. We received the call that would forever shatter our lives on September 18, 1998. It was my 50th birthday. Although Brian was not himself intoxicated, he had gotten into the vehicle with someone who was, a person he believed to be his friend. Brian was a big guy with an extra kind heart. He died on the pavement. Brian's family and friends were devastated. A part of all of us died along with Brian that night. Brian could have been anyone's son. Wilson was convicted of criminal negligent homicide, DUI, and 2 assault fours for the other 2 victims. The assault fours were thrown out at sentencing due to judicial error. Wilson was sentenced to 18 months for criminally negligent homicide, 12 months for DUI, a total of 30 months for 50 to 60 years of my son's life. It was hardly justice. Wilson served a total of 20 months. We had to fight to keep him there that long. We basically had to babysit the sentence, the conviction. He has since moved on with his life. We are still grieving. Since our son's death, there have been several similar deaths in Lane County, some with even shorter sentences. These newspaper clippings are of vehicular homicides from our local newspaper. They represent 15 deaths, 13 of which are the result of drunk drivers. Only one does not involve alcohol, and the other is Russell Lee Stubbs. Only 2 have resulted in a manslaughter conviction. Most convictions were a plea bargain. Prosecutors most often have to stack the charges to get any kind of a substantial statement. Kevin Edward Headinghouse is another one that really stands out for me. He was not only intoxicated, he was high on pot when he killed 2 people. One was his sister, one was his brother's girlfriend. He had 2 previous DUI arrests that had been resolved through diversion. Headinghouse was sentenced to only 18 months. Individuals who commit these careless, reckless, senseless crimes are a very direct threat to all of us. These are crimes without motive, often striking indiscriminately without warning. These are dangerous criminals. The sentence should incarcerate these individuals long enough to make a difference by educating them and rehabilitating them and setting an example. There needs to be some sort of deterrent. There should be zero tolerance for this sort of crime. 18 months for criminally negligent homicide after good time equates to only a slap on the wrist. The Lovelace family has found the courage to fight back through legislation. The least our family can do is stand beside them. We cannot have our loved ones back, but we can work towards strengthening our laws and making the punishment fit the crime, hopefully saving lives. I believe that drunk driving convictions should be placed in a subcategory under manslaughter with a mandatory sentence of 50 to 60 months. Passing Senate Bill 473 is a step in the right direction. Thank you for this opportunity. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Mrs. Pratt, thank you. Any questions from the committee? And Mr. Pratt, comment?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee,
Thank you for allowing us to testify today. My name is Bruce Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and NAD. I'm a Lane County businessman, and I'm speaking here on my own behalf. I'm here today to please ask you to advance Senate Bill 473. My wife mentioned the word deterrent, and I think that is the main thing that I would like to see this bill have happen. As I've stated in my written testimony, about 200 people were killed in Oregon by drunk drivers last year. Most of the people who committed these acts were convicted of criminally negligent homicide, and most were sentenced only to 16 to 18 months. We all know that an automobile is a lethal weapon when being driven by an irresponsible person. Add alcohol to that formula, and the result is an extremely dangerous situation that most of us would recognize. Anyone who disregards this obvious danger should be held accountable, especially when a life is taken. Raising the classification for criminally negligent homicide and manslaughter in the second degree to Category 9 in the sentencing guidelines would be a step in the right direction. I also believe that death at the hands of a drunk driver should be a subsection in the definition of manslaughter in the second degree to include a person with criminal negligence while under the influence of a controlled substance or intoxicants causes the death of another human being by means of a motor vehicle. Now, this is one of the most expensive crimes that we face in this in our society, is the drunk driving death. So in order to get that deterrent going, and to get every driver's attention and disseminate the information about the penalties for driving under the influence of intoxicants, I suggest that there might be a statement on the motor vehicles, that the motor vehicles require drivers to sign when they renew their licenses. A statement that they understand the penalties for driving under the influence of intoxicants. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Mr. Pratt, thank you very much. I don't sense that there are any questions right now. Appreciate your time. Ingrid Swenson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do oppose both of these measures. I'd like to speak about them separately, if I might. With respect to Senate Bill 472, I think the thing that has to be kept in mind is we're not talking about causation in the injury or death. That's not what's at issue in the hit-and-run law. The hit-and-run law talks about your responsibility after being involved in some kind of traffic accident and what your job is. The same responsibility applies to the person who is the victim of that accident as to the person who caused it, if there is a particular person who caused it. So when we're talking about it, again, it's what happens after the accident. It doesn't assume that you are responsible, that you harmed or killed somebody either negligently or recklessly or intentionally. It assumes that the harm has occurred, and then it is concerned with what occurs after that. So basically, this law could apply to a person who was entirely the victim in the accident. If you were driving along a road, obeying the speed limit, and some car skips a stop sign and rams into you, and the driver of that car is injured or killed, and there are other people in that car, that would be a B felony if you left that scene of that accident, even though you had nothing to do with the cause of that injury or that accident whatsoever. And one can imagine that there might be circumstances where you would choose to do that. If it were a car of young people who were angry and perhaps intoxicated who had run into you, you're by yourself, and the statute doesn't say, well, you have a fear so you don't have to stay there. It says everybody has to stay there unless you're seeking medical care, and there are some specific exemptions. So it would create a Class B felony for you, the victim of that accident, to leave the scene because you were fearful of what might happen to you at the scene.
Mr. Chair,
so,
Senator Duncan.
Could I ask you a question? Okay, I understand what you're saying. That's kind of a different situation. Could there be some provision written in? Because I don't think that's what anyone's trying to get at. I understand that particular one, but how do you deal with the other one?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, I agree. I think there should be a discussion about the difference between people who cause accidents mm-hmm. and have an additional level of responsibility, we would think, from the people who don't. But as other witnesses have indicated, this statute isn't directed at the cause of the accident. There are other laws that are, and Senate Bill 473 addresses those. This one just talks about your duty after an accident. And in addition, as the chair has pointed out, you may not know what happened at the scene of this accident. You may have good reason to know, and this individual, Mr. Stubbs, obviously had good reason to know what happened. But a death may or may not be something that is an obvious outcome of that accident. So again, no distinction is made in the law currently or in this bill between people who knew they caused a death versus people who didn't know they caused a death or even an injury, perhaps. And in some ways, it is to the injured whom we owe the greater duty. Obviously, if there's something you can do as a person who's present at the scene of this accident, it becomes critically more important for you to be there and do that and render whatever aid you're capable of rendering at the scene. The chair also talked about the possibility of looking at the behavior in this particular case, which is probably the cause of most people's concern about it. And that isn't just the accident. That isn't just the fact that he left. People do panic and make stupid decisions to leave the scene of an accident. And even if you went two blocks and said, oh, that was terrible, I can't live with myself, I must go back and render aid, you've already violated this statute. You've already committed a Class B felony if it becomes that. So maybe there is room to talk about the difference in behavior between the person who panics, who didn't cause the accident, who was hit by somebody else, but who panics and leaves that scene and then later thinks, this is wrong, I shouldn't have done that, and the person like this person who not only causes the injury and the death, chooses to leave, and then calculatedly and cold-heartedly decides to camouflage his vehicle. And then there was another case where somebody shipped their vehicle off to Europe, hoping that it wouldn't be found and so forth. Those are quite different circumstances. So our concern is that it sweeps too broadly and picks up people probably who should not be included in the Class B felony treatment. With respect to...
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I guess you've been hearing all the discussion today, and I think you can probably detect there's a lot of sympathy on the part of Lovelace's and the Pratts, the kind of the concern that they have. How would you rewrite this bill to deal with their issue and to deal with the concerns you've addressed?
Mr. Chair and Senator
Duncan. Is that
Duncan?
Possible?
He always gives me these difficult questions. I think as other, as members of your committee have already mentioned, there are ways of dealing with pieces of behavior where it doesn't just take the crime as a solitary, unitary thing and say, in every crime of this nature, we will increase the penalty, but look at particular kinds of behavior and either use those as aggravating factors. In this case, that wouldn't have helped because obviously he was already aggravated in order to be sent to prison anyway. But you could certainly structure the the offense or the penalty for the offense to take into account these particular circumstances.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I guess I would be interested in, at some point, hearing from the district attorney and the assistant district attorney, and maybe if you want to go that direction, Mr. Chair, to see how they've heard this too. Is there any way to deal with this from their standpoint?
Okay, good. We'll give them an opportunity. Ingrid, are you finished with?
Could I testify about 473 separately, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we also oppose 473. Now, here you are talking about the behavior of the person who caused the accident or the crash, which is probably a better term than an accident in a lot of these cases. The difficulty, we understand the rationale for raising manslaughter, if you're going to raise criminally negligent homicide, and that's not what I'm here to talk about. Manslaughter is already a 75-month minimum, so what you do to that is almost academic. But with respect to the criminally negligent homicide, we do oppose raising that as recommended by this bill to classify it as a 9, because it takes it out of the optional probation provisions of the guidelines. And the behavior we're talking about is negligent. That means that someone failed to be aware of a risk. It doesn't mean someone who intentionally did an act or even recklessly did an act disregarding the risk. It means someone was unaware of the risk. They should have been. They should have been aware of the risk, but for whatever reason, they were not. And under those circumstances, caused a death. The law treats that as less serious than people whose state of mind is more aggravated. And that's why the difference has been there. And it's a difference that's throughout the criminal code in terms of your behavior. As we've discussed before, the relevant factors are usually the nature of the injury and the seriousness of the injury, a weapon, if any, was used, and then the state of mind of the defendant. We punish people more harshly when they intend to do wrong than when they don't intend to. And criminally negligent homicide punishes negligent behavior. If you're intoxicated and you drive a car in such a way as to cause injury or death, that is recklessness. That's not negligence. It's recklessness, and that's already manslaughter in the second degree with a 75-month minimum sentence. If for whatever reason that can't be proved, then yes, the law assumes that your state of mind is merely negligent. And I understand that there is some benefit to people who leave the scene of an accident, for example, if they've been drinking, and it may be a reason why people choose to leave the scene in terms of it being more difficult to prove that they were intoxicated, but it certainly is not impossible based on the accident itself, the lack of any rational explanation for what occurred, some evidence that this person was either drinking or people observed him or the manner of driving. There are certainly ways to prove that. But the fact of the matter remains that if you raise this offense of criminally negligent homicide to the level that you're being asked to raise it to, there's basically no difference between negligent and reckless conduct other than the 75-month minimum. I received letters from some of my members on this bill, and many of them, of course, have represented people charged with criminally negligent homicide. The circumstances vary in those cases, but there have been many cases in which victims' families join the defendant's family in saying there is no point in treating this person as a serious felon and locking him up for the rest of his life. My child died in his car, but my child could have been driving the car if they were all intoxicated. It happens, and it's terrible. But the fact of the matter is that there is a difference between those people who act recklessly and those who act negligently, and I think that this bill does not serve the purpose of distinguishing between those kinds of behavior.
Good, thank you. Any other questions? Bill, you can go up here and tell us how much all this is going to cost.
Mr. Chair, members, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. We have not prepared an impact estimate. I can try to identify for you some of the types and the nature of impacts that we think will happen. I also want to add a couple comments. On failure to perform the duties of a driver, moving it from a Category 6 to a Category 8, from what we know right now, that would not have a substantial fiscal impact and probably not meet the threshold for a referral down to Ways and Means. From what we haven't made a lot of contacts right now, but from what we know so far, generally if your conviction for failure to perform duties of a driver is in relation to an accident that causes a death, typically those people get charged with the homicide and are not the cases that Ms. Swenson was talking about where you are a second or third party in that accident. On Senate Bill 473, increasing the crime seriousness ranking of manslaughter to a negligent homicide, my testimony I think would be a little different than what you've heard from a couple other people. First of all, I want to clarify that when you classify something in the guidelines, the number you see in the grid box is what we call a presumptive sentence. That is a sentence that should be imposed in the typical case. If it's not a typical case, then the guidelines provide for departures, which are changes from that presumptive sentence. And in order to get a departure, you need to have, under the law, a substantial and compelling reason. And so I think the discussion that you're hearing from both the defense attorneys and the prosecution is whether they have facts sufficient to prove a substantial and compelling reason to get a departure, either up or down. You've also heard a term called optional probation. I wanted to make sure that you understood the distinction between a departure and optional probation. Optional probation is available for people who are in who commit Category 8 offenses and who have a lesser criminal history, so they're in grid blocks G, H, and I. What that means is that the judge has a lesser legal standard to be able to impose a probation sentence. In order to get optional probation, the person has to show that treatment would be more effective in reducing future criminal conduct and would adequately protect public safety. And on those grounds, the judge can impose a probation sentence as opposed to having a substantial and compelling reason. So with those two clarifications, there are three types of impacts we see in Senate Bill 473. The first is that last session, this assembly adopted an exception to the Measure 11 minimum for manslaughter two cases that involve faith healing. And if the court can find that the person committed manslaughter two and it was a faith healing incident, then that is grounds for a departure out of the Measure 11 sentence, and the judge would sentence under the sentencing guidelines. So in those cases, those faith healing manslaughter cases, rather than being sentenced at a Category 8, that person would be sentenced at a Category 9. Second issue is in manslaughter two cases where you are able to get a departure above the Measure 11 minimum sentence. And so right now the Measure 11 minimum is 75 months. If you move it to basically anywhere in a Category 9, you can get a departure for anybody that will exceed that Measure 11 minimum sentence. And then finally, in negligent homicide, I would just point out that negligent homicide is a Class C felony. The statutory maximum sentence is 60 months. If you make it a Category 9, you're basically also creating a situation where the judge can impose a prison sentence up to that statutory maximum, and there can be no supervision after that person is left out of prison. So once they come out of prison, you've already hit the statutory maximum, and by law, you cannot keep that person under correctional supervision anymore. And so when you're looking at crime seriousness classification, I think you also need to look at the classification of the felony itself. So assuming you want to keep that person under supervision after they come out of the institution, that you'd have the time available to do that.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any questions? Appreciate it. All righty. Bill, we're going to move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 293, which is...
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Duncan.
Was there any chance to hear from the DA on that, or is this...
No. Yeah, let's do that. Actually, if we could bring the DA back up to give some comments. Thank you for reminding me.
That's a good question.
I think we're going to have a little work group on this anyway, but... Any comments on what you heard?
Mr. Chair, in hearing Ingrid Swenson's testimony, I guess there's a couple of three things that I'd like to bring up, and I think Mr. Hartgrove probably would agree and maybe address others. In the material that I gave to the committee, I also noted that the court will always have the ability to have a downward departure. So even though we're raising the threshold as to what we presume should be a just sentence, the judge, based on the facts in that particular case, could in fact have a downward departure. We're just raising the threshold for that level. I think it's very important for this committee to understand and recognize that this legislature has already made a distinction in the history and how we treat individuals who fail to perform duties of a driver. We already have as a misdemeanor under 811-700 for individuals who only commit property damage. And we have currently where a person commits either an accident that has injury and or death as a higher level. And so what we're asking this body to do at this point is to really advance forward the theory of breaking them out and treating them as this body has in the past as a more serious offense where there is, in fact, a death that resulting as compared to just an injury.
Mr. Chair, Doug Harkle wrote again from Lane County. Ms. Swenson indicated that talked about negligence and used that word several different times. Negligence is not a criminal act in the state of Oregon. Gross negligence is a criminal act in the state of Oregon. Simple negligence is a car crash, accidents, and people get to sue each other. And insurance companies get involved. Gross negligence is a higher standard than that, and that's the only time that negligent homicide applies is when it is gross negligence. Now, recklessness is a step above that. Recklessness is being aware of and consciously disregarding the risk, and gross negligence is failing to be aware of that risk that they should have been aware of, a substantial and unjustifiable risk. By categorizing them both at Category 9 under the sentencing guidelines grid, you make them proportionate, but because manslaughter in the second degree is a ballot measure 11 offense, that's a 75-month sentence. No good time, no early release, no parole, nothing. It's flat time, 75 months. That's not the case with Category 9 offenses, which would in this case be gross negligence or negligent homicide. And that would normally be 34 to 36 months with no significant prior record. And a downward departure, as Mr. Przanski has indicated, is available to the judge to move back into a probationary sentence with some county jail time if that's appropriate. So there is a significant difference there. Now, moving to the first bill, the failure to perform the duties of a driver involved in an accident, victims could be prosecuted if they leave the scene. Victims can be prosecuted now if they leave the scene. I didn't hear any specific examples, and I know of none in Lane County where we prosecute victims for leaving the scene of an accident. You give prosecutors great discretion. You do that now. If we want to take a murder case and make it a trespass, although I'd not suggest that's happened any place, anytime, anywhere, we could do that. And so we have discretion as to whether or not we should prosecute victims who leave the scene. And the answer is, I believe, around the state is we don't do it if there's not a good reason. Now, if the victim leaves the scene because they're driving while suspended or because they're in a stolen car, and the accident wasn't their fault, we might find a good reason to prosecute them, but not just because they leave the scene. The individual who leaves the scene, who is at fault in the accident, goes two blocks and returns to render aid. That doesn't make a very good criminal case from a prosecutor's standpoint. They had a quick decision, started to run off, turned around, and came back. That's not the kind of case that, although I suppose we could call it a technical leaving of the scene and file something, I'd suggest that most prosecutors would be very reluctant to move on that, and juries wouldn't be very sympathetic to that kind of a prosecution. So the last thing I would say is when we talk about departures, either upward or downward, Mr. Lemon would have the more current information, but I believe departures only occur about 5% of the time because it requires substantial and compelling reasons to do that. I wouldn't worry too much about that happening too often in any of this in any direction. I don't know if Mr. Hasselman has an additional comment or two or not.
Thank you, Chairman, Ms. Senator Duncan, members. I would just respond to Ms. Swenson's comments as well, that mirroring what my employer, the district attorney, says, is that we do have a lot of discretion in those type of cases, and we also have justification defenses that are built into the Oregon Revised Statutes, which allow people to take actions which they feel are necessary under the circumstances to prevent future imminent harm, such as the example that Ms. Swenson gave with the car full of teenagers or young men who were becoming physically aggressive, and the victim of the traffic collision left the scene because they were afraid of getting hurt. Those defenses are built into the statutes currently, and again, I wouldn't find that a very good case to pick out for prosecution anyway. We try to limit our selection of the cases to prosecute to people that a jury is not going to feel sorry for in those particular situations. As well, there's comments made by Ms. Swenson regarding the fact that the judge would lose the ability to impose an optional probation sentence as provided for under the Level 8 scheme, as negligent homicide currently is. My response to that is one of the recognized mitigating factors which a judge could use to impose a downward departure sentence to a probationary sentence, even from a Level 9 offense, is the optional probation criteria. And so this bill in and of itself would not, strip the sentencing court of the ability to look at those factors under optional probation and make a determination that in a circumstance with substantial and compelling reasons to do something other than the presumptive sentence, a judge could downward depart to a probationary sentence. Thank the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one other thing. Based on the evidence that you've heard today, I'm going to ask for this panel, as well as for the individuals you've heard before, to move the bills as they are instead of trying to modify them at this point. My understanding is that the legislature is kind of going into the fast track to start wrapping stuff up. And I spoke with Senator Cork, and he thought that if there was other additions that needed to be done, that possibly by passing those along to the House, that might be the place that it should be addressed. It seems to me the other suggestions that the chair has brought forward as to modifying the type of penalty, that a sanction that could be applied for some tampering of evidence, is a great opportunity, but I don't know if these are the vehicles that they should be used to actually accomplish that.
Well, let me just tell you what my intent is at this point, and the direction I've given to council is to roll all of these bills into one.
Okay.
Including the sentencing guidelines. Criminal Justice Commission's work, so that's all into one bill that moves across the chamber. That'll limit the amount of votes that we have to take on this particular issue. So, and I think we can come back with some amendments fairly quickly.
Okay.
I'll have to depend on Mr. Lemon to supply us with some fiscal. I don't know how long it's going to take to do that. But, and Phil, you were shaking your head no on the 5% departure issue. Do you want to clarify that for us? And
I'd like to hear that.
Mr. Chair, Phil Lemon, I would never, of course, directly contradict a person who is an attorney, much less an elected district attorney. Departures generally occur in about a quarter of the guidelines cases. Of those, two-thirds are upward departures and about one-third are downward departures. It's become more difficult to figure out what really is a departure now, because we see a lot of discretion used by DAs in pleading down from Measure 11 cases, and those I guess I'm a little reluctant to call a formal departure, but...
Aren't we talking about departures the judge has the discretion to impose at sentencing?
Well,
we're not talking about the DA's decision to charge something other than...
Mr. Chair, I would have to go back and look at our data to tell you how many departures came out of a case that actually went to trial where the judge was not signing off on a stipulated plea. My numbers are based on the total of guidelines cases and prior to Measure 11.
I mean, I'm assuming that's what Mr. Harkerode was referring to, where judges are actually departing.
Where there's an actual contested case and one side is arguing for one thing and one side is arguing for another at the sentencing hearing.
Okay, well, and we can get some clarification to that. So any other questions from the committee? All right, thank you very much. Now, let me move into a quick public hearing on Senate Bill 803. This is my Hummer, by the way. Nobody signed up. And just for the committee, this, when I came to this legislature this time around, my objective was to, I guess, repeal the Criminal Justice Commission from the existence of the New Oregon Revised Statutes. What I figured after spending some time with legislative counsel was that task would be huge, and after they pled for mercy, I decided that maybe one of the best things we could do is to get at least one member from the House and one member from the Senate involved in the Criminal Justice Commission so that the legislature may better understand what their processes are as they go through making decisions in terms of ranking the various crimes that are created in legislatures. The members, one from the Senate, one from the House, are non-voting members because of the separation of powers doctrine, because this is an executive branch function, and so if the committee would agree at some point with this concept, then I would appreciate eventually rolling this into one of the other bills. Phil, do you have any comments at all you want to
hear?
Senator Byron.
And so rather than getting rid of something, we're going to add to it.
Well, I figured, actually, it's very interesting because Virginia Vanderbilt, who was the legislative council person who I asked to draft the repeal of this particular group, came to me, and the problem was that all of the rules that currently exist, that are administrative rules now drafted on part of this agency, in order to effectively keep the grid as it is, would have to be drafted in statutory language. And she was pulling her hair out of her head, trying to figure out how to make that happen, at least within the timelines that we had. She still has all that preliminary work, so if the legislature chose to repeal this organization, it's possible. So this is just a suggestion.
Do you have a senator in mind?
No. I assume that's up to the Senate president. No, it wouldn't necessarily be me. I actually served on the Senate Guidelines original committee that put these things together. And
I'm just looking for the talent.
Yeah. You'd be a great one. Phil, comments?
Mr. Chair, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. My take is that the largest impediment to repealing the Criminal Justice Commission is that nobody else volunteers to do what we do. As you know, coming up and telling people who want to enact a policy that's going to cost money is not a very popular thing to do, and it is my extreme privilege and honor to be able to perform that function for you. The commission also has expanded its duties, or I should say the legislature has expanded the commission's duties since I took over as executive director in 1995. In addition to managing the sentencing guidelines program, we administer juvenile crime prevention grants and staff the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. We provide staff to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, and we provide a series of research and analytical functions. And so that is because we do a lot of executive branch functions, that's the other reason why it's not appropriate and unconstitutional for legislative members to have voting authority on the commission.
All right. And Phil and I have been going round and round for a number of years here. But actually, to Phil's credit, he takes the heat pretty good. So, and that's one of the things, by the way, as a matter of public policy. There's no organization in the state right now that actually, I guess, tries to pull together criminal justice policy for the purpose of criminal justice policy planning. I think we talk to chiefs of police around the state. Each person who runs an agency pretty much runs it as they see fit. There's no think tank that says, look, how do we appropriate our resources within our police agencies, within the district attorney's offices, again, same thing. Nobody says, look, these are the people that we really want to target. And I guess part of my experience in the police bureau in 25 years as a police officer is that law enforcement can do a better job
of focusing our enforcement capacity on people who are prolific criminals, which is why I supported guidelines, because it's based on the seriousness of the offense and the criminal history of the individual involved, and why I support Measure 11. Because to me, if you target your resources effectively, you're getting people off the street for a long period of time who are prolific criminals. And it doesn't really work well when you're just out busting everybody who just happens to meet the minimum criteria for probable cause arrest. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But there is no agency statewide that does anything of that nature. And it seems to me that we need something. Drag Ingrid in.
We're going to build another state agency, add two more people to this one.
No, I really don't think it should be another state agency necessarily. I think that to a large extent, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and others in cooperation with each other, I think it can be accomplished. It's just not being done. It's like the community policing model. Everybody talks about how wonderful it is for, you know, law enforcement to be involved in the community. Yet in order for community policing to really be effective, you have to have the ability to work with other agencies and other people and have them available, have people with authority to make decisions. And in fact, it doesn't happen. So you don't have a coordination or connection of existing government systems, and so everybody pretty much exists as an entity unto themselves without any legitimate coordination. So I had this conversation, by the way, with my chief of police this morning, because when he came to the Portland Police Bureau, one of the first edicts he made was, I want more arrests. I'm sitting in the detective division. I'm thinking, I can probable cause arrest a lot of people. I've got probable cause for about 15 right now. I can just go out and hot bust them and put them in jail. But it doesn't do any good for me to do that, because the substance of the case isn't set out in a way that it's going to be a successful prosecution. So what I end up doing by following through that policy is just putting a lot of people in jail and causing the district attorney's office to spend a lot of time reviewing bad cases, and we're not necessarily making good choices with respect to the enforcement dollars that we have. Case in point, if we had opportunity to do this, and hopefully we will, fraud crimes in the state of Oregon are going through the roof, exponential. I mean, and they're just climbing through the roof. So we talked about identity theft. I don't know how many reports a day the Portland Police Bureau are taking, but it's huge. And if you look at fraud, look at what banks are eating in terms of the costs for fraudulent credit card and check-kiting schemes and so on and so forth, those crime categories are growing exponentially, where violent persons' crimes are going downward. So, I think the legislature and public policymakers need to look at whether or not we can effectively target individuals who are lifelong criminals who spend most of their life devoting themselves to ripping people off, or if we just go out and bust every single person who, you know, writes a forged check and throw them in prison. Anyway, enough of my dissertation. I'll close the public hearing on my bill and open a public hearing on your bill, Phil.
Well, what am I doing on your bill?
Would you want to act on the bill? I'm ready to move it.
Actually, we'll talk. I want to roll it in.
Okay. Could we take off two people and keep it at seven?
Yeah.
Could we take off four people and get it across?
Let's just make it you and me. Phil, go ahead.
We can fix this thing, you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. Senate Bill 293 is before you because the statutes require that any time the commission modifies the sentencing guidelines rules, we need to come back and get your ratification to have them continue in effect. And so what I'm going to try to do is give you a brief background of sentencing guidelines, how they interact with other sentencing statutes, and then very quickly hit the highlights of what these rules contain. Just for your information, this notebook contains all the bills that we went through from the 99 session to arrive at the rule changes, which are about 60 pages, which I have for you if you need trouble or need some help getting to sleep at night. But beyond that, I'll just try to hit the highlights and run through them so you have a sense of what's in there without boring you to tears with details. You've seen the guidelines grid, and what that does basically is the way the law used to work is the legislature would establish a classification of felonies which has, for example, a five-year statutory maximum. The judge can sentence any length of time up to that maximum, and then it was up to the parole board to determine how long that person actually stayed in prison. And by the early 1980s, both the legislature and the people had not been able to build additional prison resources, so the parole board was serving as a release function rather than a selective who needs to stay in function. And so the the policy choice that came about was sentencing guidelines. And the guidelines are based on four principles. The first is proportionality. And we accomplished that by using the seriousness of the crime and the criminal history to establish a proportional range of sentences depending on those two variables. We give extra weight to people who have prior convictions for person offenses, such as assaults, homicide, and sex offenses, so they serve more time under guidelines. Second concept, with truth in sentencing, we abolish parole release and limited sentence reduction to a maximum of 20% earned time credit. Measure 11 and other laws take that a step further and prohibit any earned time credit, but guidelines was our first step at truth in sentencing. The third is uniformity, and that's to provide some structure and guidance to judges throughout the state so that a person whose characteristics of their offense and their criminal history were the same could expect to receive a similar sentence. And we do that by creating a presumptive sentence and limiting judicial discretion on departures, which is what we call any change from that presumptive sentence. And the fourth principle was that the system should be able to deliver the penalties that it promises. And to accomplish that, we kind of rolled those into the other three changes, but also that's where you get down to the numbers in the boxes, because that represents the number of prison beds you have to build, the number of probation and parole officers you need to hire to supervise these people. And so we use a lot of the sentencing guidelines data to try to estimate the impact of the other crime-related legislation that you propose and enact, and that's why I get to come here and talk to you about fiscal impact. After my testimony, there is some material that I just wanted to make sure that you were aware of. You probably have a better copy of the guidelines grid, but I want to make sure you had a copy of that. The second handout is just kind of a little step-by-step of how you sentence under the guidelines. You take the crime seriousness of the offense, which is listed on the vertical axis of the grid. You determine the offender's criminal history, which is the horizontal axis, and then the intersection of those is the presumptive sentence, which is the basis for the sentencing process. You identify any grounds for departure and then impose the sentence. And rather than take the time, I did list a couple of examples on how guidelines operate either by themselves or in conjunction with some other sentencing laws that we have. The third page in that handout is a summary of Oregon sentencing laws. And if you want to take a quick look at this table, we have a variety of laws that affect felony sentencing: dangerous offender, gun minimums, the guidelines, the Denny Smith Initiative from 1990, ballot measure 11, which took effect in 1995, and the repeat property offender sentencing law that took effect in 1997. Each of those was enacted in a little different way, affects a little different population, and one of the things that I get to help you sort out is how all the pieces fit together. But they all establish different sentencing lengths. They treat juveniles differently. Some allow a sentence reduction through earned time or boot camp or other mechanisms. Others do not. And the other thing you'll find on that table is an approximate number of the people sentenced per year under each of those sentencing mechanisms. So I hope that provides some useful background as well.
Phil, on the gun minimum, it shows that there are 50 people roughly sentenced each year. Now, is that usually concurrent with some other sentence for another charge?
Yeah.
It's a five-year minimum now, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, I haven't looked at this since last session. If I remember correctly, it is up to 5 years on the first offense, the first time you are charged with and convicted of using a firearm in the commission of a felony. The judge has a discretionary ability to impose a minimum sentence up to 5 years. That typically does, and the best I can tell you right now is that use of the gun minimum has dropped pretty dramatically after passage of Measure 11, because prosecutors apparently feel that they get sufficient penalties with Measure 11 without having that enhanced gun minimum sentence on it. I can get you more information on that if you're interested, but
yeah, actually,
that's what I can tell you off the top of my head.
I would be interested, particularly with all of the attention given to crimes committed with guns.
And that says, Mr. Chair, 50, approximately 50 a year.
Yes.
Gun felonies.
That's where the enhancement for felony with a gun is being sentenced.
Very interesting.
Under that stat, Mr. Chair, if I may, under that statute, the DA must plead in the indictment and prove that a firearm was used in the commission of a crime. The first time that happens, the judge can impose a minimum sentence up to 5 years for that offense. If it happens a second time, then it becomes a mandatory sentence and it's longer, is basically how that works. but there are very few people who come in with that mandatory second or subsequent gun minimum sentence. Most time are their first time.
But I guess my point is it's not in addition to a Measure 11 sentence or a guideline sentence. It is running concurrent with it, if I understand correctly.
Mr. Chair, if it's your first time with a gun minimum, then any mandatory minimum under Measure 11 is going to exceed the 60 months that's available for the first time. If you do it a second time, then the gun minimum could exceed the mandatory minimum under Measure 11.
Thank you.
So now that you're all experts on guidelines and the intersection with other laws, I want to just run you through briefly what some of the major changes are, and I'll go back to my written testimony. Generally, the process is we gather all the bills that the legislature passes that affect felony sentencing and felony crimes, and we put them all in a notebook. We send each sponsor of every bill in this notebook a letter saying we're doing rulemaking. We send all the committee chairs a letter saying, hey, we're doing rulemaking. If you want to participate, please let us know. And then we come back without any additional legislative input and get to do this with you. The commission appoints a committee of practitioners. We have district attorneys, defense lawyers, judges, parole and probation officers, Department of Corrections, a sheriff, just kind of your interest panel. Staff recommends rule changes. That group goes through and makes their own recommendations to the commission. The commission adopts them as rules. For some rules, the commission's decisions take effect upon the rulemaking process. We have to come back to you. If you do not approve these rule changes, then the rule changes sunset. On other types of changes, we have to get your permission in advance before they take effect. And so we have a couple different kind of things going on. But there are four different categories. One is to rank in the crime seriousness scale the crimes that you passed last session. And there are 20 newer modified felonies from 1999 that we're looking at. And the quickest way to summarize those is to look in my testimony. There's a table on page 10 that lists the bill number, the types of felonies we're looking at, the crime seriousness ranking that the commission established, and that are subject here for your review today. The second type of decision that the commission makes is whether to classify these crimes as a person crime. And we do that for these 20 new felonies and also for the 20 new Class A misdemeanors that the legislature last session either created or modified. And those decisions are summarized for you in the table on page 11. The next group is responding to other legislation that affects sentencing guidelines but does not, we were not directed or otherwise required to take an action. Those include things like modifying criminal histories, if you're expanding the duration of post-prison supervision for sex offenders, some of those changes that we pick up. And then any housekeeping or technical corrections, also we need to come to you and get your formal permission to do that. So if I can just direct your attention to the table on page 10, we have five felonies that are election law felonies. Traditionally, we have left those unranked. There are very few of those, and we find that those are best approached on a case-by-case basis. If the commission and the legislature does not rank a crime, then the judge in every case does a case-by-case review, puts on the record what the crime seriousness ranking is and the reasons for that, and then sentences accordingly. So by leaving them unranked, it can be anything from a 1 to an 11 based on that. But those are cases where we feel that the factual circumstances are such that it's best left to a judge on a case-by-case basis. The fourth bill on that table, felony DUI and driving while suspended under House Bill 2002, in that case, the legislation that was passed last session specifies that felony drunk driving shall be classified as a Category 6. The same bill took most what were felony driving while suspended and made those misdemeanors. The ones that are remaining were, again, directed by statute to be ranked at a Category 6. House Bill 2273 takes what we generically call sliming offenses. These are assaulting a corrections officer with a bodily substance. If you want to know the specifics of the substances, I'll let you read the statute, but that's why we have another phrase for it. We took no action in the rules for that. That means that those are treated the same as any other assault 3, and they are Category 6 person crimes. Money laundering, House Bill 2319, that's an example of ones that we left as unranked. We have a statutory scheme for property offenses that is the crime seriousness is based on the dollar value of the property that's lost. The DA's association came in and argued that money laundering is different than a property loss situation, and they would have preferred having that left unranked, and so we accommodated their request.
Bill, since that was one of my bills, how many people have been sentenced for money laundering in the state since the passage?
Mr. Chair, I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
I know of only one indictment. I don't know if it's actually gone to trial or not.
I know the testimony last session was that it would be very infrequently used, and if there were a lot of them, I'd probably remember it, but I can't, but I'll let you know. Identity theft was a new felony that was created last session. We did put that in the property series, which means that they are ranked categories 2 through 6, the same as theft and forgery and other offenses in that nature. The legislature also added repeat identity theft to the repeat property offenders bill, which means if you have, and Senator Byer, I believe this was probably your bill, if I remember correctly, if the person has 2 convictions for identity theft, or if they have a record of repeated property offenses, then they qualify for a 13-month sentence under the repeat property offenders law. And that, I think, kind of covers the highlights there, unless you have other specific questions.
The repeat property offense, 13 months.
13 or 19.
13 or 19. Can a judge go more?
Yes.
I mean, that's substantial and compelling.
Yes, and I was going to get that a little bit later, but okay. One of the things, there's a court of appeals ruling that the legislature addressed last time where the person was subject to repeat property offenders law with a 13-month sentence, and otherwise the person was a 3C under the sentencing guidelines. So the judge imposed an 18-month sentence, and the question was whether the judge had to do one departure based from that 13-month sentence or 2 departures based from the 3C ranking. Court of Appeals said that you had to use the guidelines sentence as the basis for any departures, which means you have to have 2 departures to get to 18 months. And so one of the things that this bill does is ratify a change adopted last session that says that repeat property offender sentence, that 13 or 19 month, is a presumptive sentence and therefore serves as the basis for any departure. So it's one of those little technical things that we do. Then very briefly, the other thing that we do is run through and designate crimes as person offenses. And this came up a little bit in your discussion on the DUI bills. For example, if a person comes in and has 2 misdemeanor convictions for a drunk driving prior to last session, that would count only if that person was convicted of a vehicular homicide, a manslaughter or negligent homicide. Last session, one of the changes made by House Bill 2002 is that every 2 misdemeanor convictions counts as a person felony for any felony that involves operation of a motor vehicle. And so what that means is that if you have 2 prior drunk driving convictions, you now come in as a Category D person instead of an H or a G. And so the legislature has already made that policy choice that we are enacting here. I guess the other thing I should point out right now is that all the commission's decisions on these rules were made by a unanimous vote. There were split votes in the Sentencing Guidelines Subcommittee with one member opposing, wanted the election law violations to be ranked instead of unranked, and same with the money laundering, they wanted ranked instead of unranked. And then there were 4 bills in the misdemeanor category where both the committee and the commission voted to make them person offenses, where this individual thought that was inappropriate. And so the first of those is Senate Bill 848, which creates an A misdemeanor directing a laser light at a police officer. The staff recommendation was not to rank that as a person offense. There is no specific element in that crime that either presents or implies the threat of physical injury or imminent physical injury, which typically has been the standard that we have used. The members felt that there were circumstances where if, for example, a police officer is in an alley, a dark alley, they see a laser light being pointed on them, that means or could mean that a gun, a laser sight is being pointed at them and they are at risk of imminent physical injury, and so they voted to classify that as a person crime. And so the commission does classify that offense as a person crime. To kind of operate together, that is House Bill 2612, which created a new A misdemeanor private indecency, and also House Bill 3596, which created a new felony of public indecency, but also what the committee did was say that generally those involve the same type of offense, and the distinction is where the offense occurs, if it's in a public place or not in a public place. And because the legislature directed that felony public indecency be ranked or classified as a person offense, that the subcommittee felt that it was more consistent to have both private indecency and public indecency as misdemeanors also ranked as person offenses. And the final one is House Bill 3591, which created a new A misdemeanor of interfering with making a police report. That came to the legislature basically in domestic violence situations where an assault is either ongoing or imminent and the assaulter rips out the phone cord or destroys the person's ability to call for help. And because, again, there was a direct relationship to physical injury, that the, both the subcommittee and the commission voted to make that a person crime. That kind of hits the highlights. There are some other enactment and follow-through type changes that, if you would like, Mr. Chair, I can briefly discuss. Otherwise, I'll wrap it up.
I think we're fine. Most members have questions. And just for the members, the, you know, the decision of the legislature was to affirmatively do something with respect to these rules, as opposed to the way it was originally adopted, where it became law unless the legislature did something to change it. Years ago, we decided that we thought we ought to play at least some role in here. So even though it looks kind of difficult and complex, and it is really, if you stop and think about it, it's something that we think the legislature should spend some time looking at. With respect to prison population, we have not had any presentation so far on prison population capacity and so on and so forth. Do you have any figures with respect to whether our prison populations are actually paralleling projections or any of that information?
Mr. Chair, those are now done by the Department of Administrative Services. They just released the new forecast last week in Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. We are still expanding our prison population, although the growth rate is continuing to edge down a little bit. So more beds, but not growing as fast as we thought we were. I can get you copies of the forecast and get them to this committee if you'd like. Or
I appreciate it if you would. I think it's kind of helpful for us to know where those are going. And we'll bring all of these things back together. Again, my intent is to take the bills that we have before us and try to roll them into one particular piece of legislation to move them through the body, and I'll be meeting with the members to kind of talk about how they want that to be constructed. Now, were there any particular issues that were extremely controversial or?
Mr. Chair, no. And that's the reason I kind of highlighted where the split votes were, because that, in my mind, is an indication of where there were conflicting issues of opinion and that I wanted to make sure that you were aware of. Frankly, those were not as contentious as some of the ones we've had in the past. One of the issues we've had over time, that as the legislature has expanded the crime of assault 3 and moved things from misdemeanor assault 4 into felony assault 3, the commission that first did look at, instead of putting those in with the other assault 4s, which are category 6s, to make them at some lesser crime seriousness, every time we did that, the legislature said, no, rank them as a 6. And so you will find that since a time or two of that, we have consistently ranked all those crimes as a 6, and so they keep coming to you that way, and those are the assumptions that we make.
All right. Good. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 293. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 492. Anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 492? No? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 492. And we're adjourned.